Let me very briefly introduce myself. I'm Dr. Edith Gutrzybylska. I'm an assistant professor at the Polish Academy of Sciences and the Institute of Philosophy and Sociology. And I'm very happy to be here today to talk about the work that actually we've been doing together with one of my colleague friend, Robert Czehy, Dr. Robert Czehy, who is a professor of political science right now at the Corvinus University in Hungary. So what we wanted to do is to look at Hungary and Poland and to tease out and study how populism, Euroscepticism is different, if it is different than that of countries of the West or the South of Europe. And we also wanted to discuss these two concepts under one roof. So we were focusing on Eurosceptic populism, and I'm going to tell you how we eventually came to this conclusion. And what was the key finding of our research? As you see, not so short title of my presentation, we were mainly focusing on anti-imperialism and historical grievances in this context. And I'm super happy to give you some insight to this research. The first question is about like why we have been looking in this specific region. And there were many reasons why we were doing this. Not only that we are living here and we wanted to have a better understanding about this these problems around us, but also because we've seen that Central Eastern Europe and Hungary and Poland in it, they became kind of a pioneer countries or pioneer region in a sense that democratic and rule of law backsliding and populism became super prominent in the last, 1.5 decade. Yes, it has been spiraling outside of this region, but these two countries were specifically like laboratories from this perspective. So we wanted to emphasize this first and foremost. The second aspect was that we discussed it back and forth, that there is a huge discrepancy in a sense that we're talking about countries where we have pro-European Union societies that are voting for Eurosceptic governments. Hungary is again a textbook case for this, but also Poland between 2015 and 2023 was quite a schoolbook example for that. And the third, which is somehow related to this, is that the European Union is being used by these governments as a rhetorical punchbag, as an external enemy, very prominently, while this region is the utmost biggest recipient of EU funds. So Hungary and Poland are on the top of net beneficiaries of the EU integration when it comes to EU funds and so on and so forth. So these were the kind of the problems that we were revolving around and wanted to get a better understanding of. Doesn't want to move again. Okay, yeah, here I just wanted to show you this. I'm pretty sure you're familiar with this research of varieties from democracy, of democracies, of Wiedem Institute, that was showing that indeed, Poland and Hungary has been the ultimately most problematic country on a global scale in between 2010, when Viktor Orban came to power, and then later on, Jarosław Kaczyński came to power, and 2020. So you can see that here, these two countries are ranking the highest when it comes to autocratization, which was eventually leading to Poland becoming an electoral democracy from liberal democracy and Hungary, which is although ranking second, but it's even more problematic because from electoral democracy, it was downgraded to electoral autocracy. So that just, to show like how exactly these two countries have been looking on the global scale. It's gonna move on. Okay, I'll just go back to make it easier. And just to make sure that, we are both understanding what we were looking at and to say a few words about the key concepts. When it comes to populism, we have been conceptualizing it following Kasmuda, who has been defining it as a thin center ideology. So we were approaching this kind of ideational approach when it comes to talking about populism, which is as you all know, is dividing the society into two antagonistic groups, the pure people, in contrast to the corrupt elite. So this is the very basis that we have been building up our conceptual framework on. Probably you might ask why we have used this approach. We can talk about it in the Q&A. I think it's a very interesting discussion. Why this and not, I don't know, populism as a discourse only. So we have been focusing on this and this kind of dichotomy, also emphasizing the way how populists are not only dividing the society between the pure people and the corrupt elite, but then how it actually manifests through a constant struggle in between these two groups when it comes to culture, economy, many, many different spheres of life. When it comes to Euroscepticism, is we think, and we were arguing that this is a much less abstract concept with more focused ideas on technically opposing EU integration. And although it might be a little bit outdated, or seems like it's a bit outdated, that we were following Paul Taggart and Alex Cherbiak in this regard, meaning that, you know, they have been arguing that there are soft and hard Eurosceptics. Hard Eurosceptics are those who would be completely rejecting EU integration per se, as an idea. And soft Eurosceptics are those who are not definitely or not necessarily against EU as such, the whole idea, but they're certainly criticizing different policies throughout which the EU integration manifests. I agree if you feel like this might be a little bit problematic approach after Brexit, and we can also talk about it during the Q&A, why is it so, and I agree with that, but right now that's what we have, so we have been following this conceptual framework. And out of this, it seems like a very simplistic, so to say, dialectic, but that what we are arguing is that Eurosceptic populism is when the corrupt elite is being identified with the EU. And as simplistic as it sounds, this is exactly the core basis of the politics of Viktor Orban, but it has been also and still the core basis of Jarosław Kaczyński in Poland, leading the biggest oppositional party against Donald Tusk's government. So these are the very basic concepts. And what we were doing in this article, which was, by the way, published before COVID lockdown and before the whole world had got shut down. So we've been working on this on the previous years of that. We wanted to problematize and look at these issues through crisis. And of course, before crisis, we were focusing mostly on rule of law, which is still very prominent in Central Eastern Europe, but not only. Also migration, which has become one of the biggest ultimate crises as of 2015, all over Europe. And then, of course, later on, there was COVID and then war in Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at the paper, which I think we're going to show, share very soon, David's going to in the chat at the end of the conversation, you're going to see that we were mainly focusing on rule of law and migration before we got published. And we were thinking, okay, why is it relevant? Why do we need to look through crisis? And we thought that this is important because populists are utilizing and instrumentalizing the crisis, no matter the nature of it. So populists are questioning the legitimacy of the mainstream elites throughout this crisis, and they put populist kind of powers under more favorable light. So that's one thing. It's also relevant because crises are more often performed by populists to create a conflict between the people and others, between the pure people and the corrupt elite, as it has been argued by Moffat. And also because crisis is often described as a sort of a transformative kind of event, which is important because it has implication to challenge the existing value structure in the form of a new distribution of culture, economic, and political resources. So these are just very basics that we thought that this is a good idea, good idea to do it around like these problems in the article. And another thing, it's not only about, you know, the us versus them, the othering, the corrupt elite versus the pure people. where populism and democracy are, so to say, related in a very, so to say, problematic correlation is that populists are looking at democratic institutions as those that are fail to carry out the general will of the good people. So there's this kind of argumentation that, you know, the courts are bad and the different kind of institutions that are capable of checking up on the government, they're not doing their job, they're not effective enough. So they're serving the interests of the corrupt elite. This is the very basics also on the domestic level. And they argue that they're simply not considered to be the right representative of the right people. So this is the kind of the chain of logic which gets them to justify that there has to be a takeover of the existing institutions because they're simply not delivering for the people. They're not effective enough to get things done. And this is how both Viktor Orban and Jaroslaw Kaczynski have been justifying their authoritarian remodeling. They were saying that this is a good change. This is a change that is needed for the people in order to get things done for them. And of course, this is applicable to the European Union eventually, which is as corrupt as it gets, according to their views. But this is just, you know, also not to get lost in the details, but when it comes to this kind of dichotomy that they're trying to maintain here, I just wanted to give you an idea how this kind of vertical and horizontal polarization looks like in these countries. As you can see in the vertical side, the polarization strategy is in between Brussels versus the people. So it's always something above us, something out there, you know, the corrupt elite representing some kind of foreign power. So it has a very strong conspiracy element. Like, and I put there the Hungarian flag so that you can see that this was super, super prominent in the Hungary and still very prominent in the Hungarian discourse, that the corrupt American Democrats are trying to undermine the will of the people. Right now, it is very prominent in Hungary. In Poland, not that much. Or George Soros, as you all know, this is like a, so to say, a product which has been spread around not only in Central Eastern Europe, but also in the Balkans and also in among American Republicans and so on and so forth. George Soros that is cooperating with the EU to, again, undermine the will of the people. Or another very prominent element is the illegitimate opposition versus the people, which is hugely problematic because if you think about it from the pluralistic point of view, naming, blaming, and shaming your opponents as illegitimate makes it like super uncivilized, meaning that there is absolutely no way that there is a space for dialogue or to discuss or debate things, because then this is a zero-sum game where the populists are thinking that we're the only one who are representing the people, and anybody who wouldn't agree with us, they're just illegitimate, period. When it comes to horizontal polarization, just to show you that it's not only over the you know, the big corrupt elite out there, but also there are internal enemies, for instance, and this is, I think this is huge, not only Central Eastern Europe, but elsewhere. This Eurosceptics is that they blame and shame and attack the LGBTQI community, so sexual minorities, gender and feminism, that they say that this is against traditional family values. Or in Hungary, that was very prominent, hardworking people like us, Fidesz, you know, like Fidesz people are voting for Fidesz against minorities like homeless people or Roma people, you know, which is a big ethnic minority in Hungary, people who are most deprived, who have less access to resources and so on and so forth. And of course, the most general polarization is the us versus them, like meaning that us against the migrants and foreigners are against us, or liberal ideas of, I don't know, vegetarian bicycle riders. This is a direct quote from Poland from a couple of years ago, when the Polish Minister of Foreign Affairs was talking against them, you know, that they're against the traditional way of Catholic Polish living. So that's the base case. And what we're arguing in this article, in our work, is that was our theoretical expectation, that this is not only about that, I mean, the reasoning in Central Eastern Europe why it eventually is against the European Union, we have to take a look at the historical traumas and humiliation of these countries. And this is not only because of what happened, you know, Second World War and before, but what happened after, during the communist, the Russian occupation, USSR occupation. What we found is that what we're arguing is that the so to say, the re-elaboration of the communist past and this kind of communist occupation, it was such a huge trauma for Poland and Hungary and the whole region eventually, that it provided a unique opportunity structure for many things. And I was just highlighting a few here. One of them is that right-wing populism became super strong in our region and not left-wing populism. And if you take a look at left-wing populist parties are really minuscule. It's dominantly right-wing populism, and it's dominantly anti-imperialist in a sense that while it is arguing against this kind of occupation of the communist regime in the past, it is re-elaborated the whole thing and it started to focus on the European Union. And the key message became that we will not let the corrupt EU elite to dictate us. By the way, this is also the title of our article. So this is the key message, that this kind of, instead of culpabilization and victimization, the whole heroization of these societies in Central and Eastern Europe has been used and reused and abused and directed towards the European Union, that right now we are facing a very similar imperial kind of attack from another organization, another external power, which is not the USSR anymore, but the EU. And if you think about it, I mean, it all makes sense in a practical level, because we're talking about two governments that has been having a lot of debates and issues with the European Union in the last couple of years, because of their authoritarian remodeling. So there was a lot of tension in between these countries. And with this kind of arguing and with this kind of reasoning, they can tell their core electorate that what's happening is exactly what was happening during the communism, that there is someone outside who is trying to tell us what to do. And we will not let them to tell us what to do, because we know what's best for our people. So this was the theoretical expectations, and what we did is that we went into discourse analysis. We have been listening to different speeches. We have been going through a lot of speeches at national holidays, at party conventions, everything which has been relevant in terms of Viktor Orban and Jaroslaw Kaczynski talking about the issue of the European Union and their countries in the European Union. And what we were finding is, as you can see, I picked two direct quotes from them. These are very much resembling to each other. Viktor Orban was talking about, like, we didn't let Vienna to dictate us in 1848. We didn't let Moscow to dictate us in 1956. And now we won't let Brussels or others to dictate us. And Jaroslaw Kaczynski has been arguing very similarly. He was saying many times, different instances, that we will not let no one in the EU to indicate what path we should take, how we should take care of our countries, how do we take care of our constitution. We are not a colony. We will not go. We will go on our own way. So these are indicative speeches. And if you, hopefully you're going to read our paper, you're going to see that there were many others with regards to not only the rule of law, but also migration, because migration is really like a glue here, that they have been building their argumentation against the EU, that the EU is dictating and wants to dictate for Poland and Hungary, based on this kind of logic of, you know, they want to embrace Islam, they want to have a mixed culture. Viktor Orban went as far as he was talking about the great replacement theory, that George Soros is working together with the EU to replace Hungarians with Muslims, and, you know, all these kind of conspiracy theories. But definitely there was a lot of reference to colonialism, imperialism, and all these kind of issues, which has been effectively, in case when it comes to the USSR. And I also wanted to show you some recent, so to say, manifestation of these ideas, because you know, many years passed since we published this article, and the war broke out, like Russia invaded Ukraine, and there's an economic downturn, so on and so forth. So I wanted to show you two billboards here, which I think just brilliantly grasps this kind of ideas. On the left, you can see this was when Jaroslaw Kaczynski was still in power. They were putting out their billboard saying that because of the climate policies of the EU, the energy prices in Poland have been raising for 60%. So this is like loud and clear. I mean, it says that no matter like what's going on in our countries, by the way, economic downturn wasn't as bad in Poland as in Hungary, yet they have been arguing that we're technically under attack. Your monthly spending is under attack because the European Union is making bad decisions, period. So it tells a story. To the right, in Hungary, and there is another billboard, which is, I would say, even harsher in a sense that this was a campaign of the Hungarian government after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So it says that the sanctions from Brussels are destroying us. And you can see that this is a very tasteless campaign because it is showing a missile, which is heading towards Hungary. So this is very much playing on the different kind of anxieties of the society. I mean, there is a war next to Hungary, because we're talking about the border country in Ukraine. And then this is the argumentation that, you know, the story was behind this, that we are in a bad economic situation because Brussels is making economic sanctions against a country which is invaded another country next to us. This was an ongoing campaign, mostly financed and like dominantly financed by public resources. And this is just one of many, because there has been plenty of these kind of campaigns financed ironically also by EU funds in the last 15 years. So these two are technically focusing on two crises, which was popping up after we published the paper, but I really wanted to show you that that's exactly the logic, how it still works. I also wanted to show you this. This was an electoral campaign billboard of the government last year ahead of the EP elections. This billboard says that these people who are sitting there are the servants of Brussels, like those who are willing to do everything in order to serve the will of Brussels. And, you know, the former ally of Viktor Orban, Ursula von der Leyen, by the way, Viktor Orban was advocating for Ursula von der Leyen to become, back then, to become the commissioner, the head of the commission. But right now, she's been scapegoated. She's been put there, and there are these guys who are the leading figures of the opposition. One of them is holding like migration. The other one is gender, and the third is says war. So we are serving everything for you, the way how you want. And these are the three kind of key messages that the government has been using and abusing to win the previous elections. You know, focusing on these conflicts. This is the base case when it comes to populist polarization. What I also wanted to show you is that there has been plenty of research conducted, like Chapel Hill Expert Survey, that tells us the story that Euroscepticism in these two countries is, as you see, very similar when it comes to argumentations and substance and so on and so forth. But when it comes to dynamism and fluctuation, the situation is a little bit different, because in contrast to Poland, Viktor Orban's party, Fidesz, has not been Eurosceptic from the very beginning. I mean, they have been quite pro-EU right from the start, and then they become hard, like almost like hard Eurosceptics. I think they're really on the verge of that today. The way how they were radicalizing over the years, as you can see, as of 2010, the Eurosceptic trend actually became a lot more prominent. In case of Poland and the Law and Justice Party that we're talking about here, PIS, it's a lot more balanced. So they have been Eurosceptics right from the start, and they actually stayed Eurosceptic up until today. So we do not see this kind of like big, so to say, deterioration against the EU or the ideas of EU integration, like we can see in the case of Viktor Orbán's Fidesz. And a very last thought that I wanted to share with you is this paper is a comparative paper on Poland and Hungary. We're not doing a huge, methodological contrasting case with South and Eastern and Western Europe, but we do have this kind of argument, like we're hinting to that in the paper, that we wanted to say something about, okay, how is it really different from what's happening in the West and in the South? Of course, I mean, in the South and the West, we don't see this kind of, it was a completely different historical dependency, path dependency. So there were no USSR occupation. So that's, of course, that's the basic. But at the same time, there are like different sophisticated ways of how is it different from Central and Eastern Europe. Because if you, at that time, we were looking at what Salvini and Marine Le Pen or the AfD were saying about the EU. What we found is that in these parties in the West, the argumentation was much stronger on anti-market liberalism. So, for instance, Matteo Salvini was talking a lot about the localization and labor market instability and fiscal autonomy of Italy back then. Or Marine Le Pen was criticizing the Eurozone for quite some time. Yes, today they are not necessarily talking about leaving the EU, as I'm not mistaken, but there has been a lot of criticism back then, and we haven't that much witnessed it that time in Poland and Hungary. And of course, there was also a lot of talking about protection of French agriculture and so on and so forth. In terms of Germany and the AfD, back then, of course, the Eurozone was under attack, then that they're not willing to join. They were also questioning economic liberalism and the European welfare tourism. And all of that that I'm listing here, or that we were listing here with Robert, is, of course, you can mostly and the best understand in the context of migration, because migration is always, these things are not happening in a vacuum. It is always related to migration and the problematization of the migration. So that's the case. In Central Eastern Europe, this is, at least when we were conducting this research, what we've seen is that this is less about the economic reasons. So it was less prominent because the economic utility has been viewed positively, very positively in these countries. It was mostly focusing on the Eurosceptic populists were mostly focusing on the European Union, how it's undermining the notion of national sovereignty, national identity and culture. So that was the key focus. And anti-globalization that time was less connected to this. What the focus was on is, I mean, on the practical level, the renationalization of key economic sectors and how is it important for these countries, or the repolonization of the media and all these kind of things. And also, in contrast to those radical parties, the outright like let's leave like Brexit type of campaign was mostly missing. So this was not like explicitly put out there that time. And again, I have to make this kind of disclosure here that this paper was published in 2020, if you read it. So probably if you look at the discourse today and what happened since 2020, I see that that economic reasons are started to become also most prominent here because of economic downturn, because of many things. I mean, I think that would eventually require another paper to write to do this kind of longitudinal contrast, like how it changed over the years, how also the nature of Euroscepticism has changed, because it indeed changed in these two cases, in case of Hungary for sure. More talking about economic reasons and how it is not that beneficial anymore to be part of the EU, because why? One thing is that there is an economic downturn in general, and the Hungarian government is not capable of managing this. Second, and this is related to this, the first point is that the EU funds are being withheld because of the rule of law crisis and corruption. So there is a lot of funds which haven't arrived to Hungary. And this is like, you know, it's easier to say, like, we don't get the money. So why does it worth? Why would it make sense for us to belong to the club that we have been belonging before? There's a lot of kind of this indicating that this is not as good as it used to be. And there is also a lot of argumentations around the Green Deal. And so this is, again, has a very strong economic kind of perspective, the protection of the agriculture and the rights and the interests of the farmers, the good people. So it is in the move, and it's in a, I would say, getting more fluctuating than before. But I think we can still argue that, in contrast to the West, there is probably even more emphasis on national sovereignty, which is eventually linked to the problem that I was talking here today about historical traumatization and anti-imperialism. And I think I would stop here, and I would be happy to take your questions and try to answer any of those that came to your mind after my presentation. Thank you so much.